We need to learn from 2010. We need to learn that we have to essentially do no harm and think about building the systems and working within existing networks that are already on the ground, these local groups and the existing networks that are there, and not try to jump in and essentially do more harm than good.
Well, we will continue, of course, to cover what's unfolding, this catastrophe in Haiti. Ann Lee, CEO and co-founder of CORE, Community Organized Relief Effort. And again, thanks to Nadesha Mehoba, Country Director, Haitian Health Foundation, speaking to us from Jeremy Ann Lee in Port-au-Prince. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Felsmeyer-Perk, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Adriana Contreras. The general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks
you
to
Megas
Daly.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Long Strange Trip, the history of the Grateful Dead, Saturday, August 21st at 6 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. This Grateful Dead documentary will be shown as a benefit for KBOO to celebrate 20 years of Grateful Dead and Friends on the air. This is an all-ages event and masks are required. You can buy tickets at kboo.fm and support KBOO getting a new studio transmitter link. Again, that's Long Strange Trip, a benefit for KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland, on Saturday, August 21st at 6 p.m.
Tune in Thursdays from 6 to 7 p.m. to hear Rose City Native Radio with your host, Jackie Malmstrom. Rose City Native Radio is a new public affairs program bringing you local and national Native issues and Native contemporary music. You can find more information about the show online at kboo.fm or find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown extends Oregon's residential foreclosure moratorium. The bootleg fire in southern Oregon is now 100% contained, and the federal government permanently boosts food stamp benefits. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 16th, 2021. I'm Althea Billings. The U.S. Forest Service's Pacific Northwest region announced that on Sunday, the bootleg fire, once the nation's largest wildfire, is now 100% contained. The fire raged for more than a month and grew to over 413,000 acres, more than twice the size of New York City. According to fire officials, the bootleg fire ignited on July 6th because of a lightning strike. The fire is among more than 100 large wildfires burning in over a dozen states in the western U.S. The flames have been stoked by drought and hot, dry weather that has turned forests, bushlands, and meadows into tinder. The U.S. Forest Service said on Friday that it is operating in crisis mode, fully deploying firefighters and maxing out its support system. About 21,000 federal firefighters are currently working on the ground, more than double the number of personnel sent to contain forest fires at this time last year. In Northern California, more than 6,000 firefighters are battling the Dixie Fire, which has burned more than 845 square miles and is 31% contained. The cause of the fire has not yet been determined. Pacific Gas and Electric has said the fire may have started when a tree fell on its power line. There is danger of new fires erupting this week due to unstable weather conditions, including extreme heat and a chance of thunderstorms that could bring lightning to Northern California, Oregon, and Nevada. According to the U.S. Air Quality Index, smoke from the fires has also driven air pollution levels to unhealthy or very unhealthy levels in parts of Northern California, Oregon, and Idaho. According to experts, climate change has made the U.S. West warmer and drier in the past 30 years and will continue to make the weather more extreme and wildfires more destructive. New COVID-19 cases jumped in Oregon this past week, rising 62%, as more than 11,500 cases were reported in the state. In comparison, the week prior had about 7,000 new cases. According to Johns Hopkins University data, Oregon ranked 18th among the states where coronavirus was spreading the fastest on a per-person basis. Within Oregon, the worst weekly outbreaks were in Morrow, Josephine, and Douglas counties. Oregon also ranked 18th among states with its share of people receiving at least one dose of a COVID vaccine. 62% of residents are at least partially vaccinated. In all, Oregon has administered more than 48 million total doses. More than 160 cases of coronavirus in Oregon have been linked to people who attended the Watershed Music Festival at the Gorge Amphitheater. More than 25,000 fans packed the Gorge for the three-day outdoor country music festival July 30th to August 1st. It marked the state's biggest concert since the pandemic began. Officials say the outbreak is the first one traced to an outdoor entertainment event since the lifting of statewide COVID-19 restrictions in June. Oregon Governor Kate Brown extended the state's residential mortgage foreclosure moratorium on Monday. Brown's second extension of the foreclosure moratorium will last through December 31st of this year. The current federal moratorium expires on September 30th. The moratorium extension was authorized by House Bill 2009. It'll prevent Oregonians from losing their homes to foreclosure if they've lost income during the pandemic. Brown said in a statement announcing the second extension, quote, "As we continue to see record high numbers of COVID-19 hospitalizations driven by the Delta surge, I'm committed to ensuring that Oregonians have a warm, dry, safe place to live during this pandemic." Extending the temporary residential foreclosure moratorium another 3 months will prevent removal of Oregonians from their homes by foreclosure, which would result in serious health, safety, welfare, and financial consequences, and which would undermine key efforts to prevent the spread of COVID-19, end quote. The moratorium can apply to 5 residential properties per owner. Each property can contain no more than 4 units. Commercial properties are excluded. Foreclosures are separate from evictions of tenants, who can still seek rental assistance from the state housing agency and from community action agencies. The legislature also passed Senate Bill 278 that bars evictions from being initiated for 60 days if tenants show proof that they have applied for rental assistance. Multnomah County has a separate ordinance setting a 90-day period. Under a different law, Senate Bill 282, tenants have until February 28th of 2022 to pay their past due rent from April of 2020 through June of this year without fear of eviction. After more than a year of the pandemic taking a heavy toll on healthcare workers, members of SEIU Local 49 in Oregon's Willamette Valley have achieved major gains in their latest contract. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Public News Service.
Nearly 600 healthcare workers in the Willamette Valley are celebrating their success in negotiations with their employers. Members of SEIU Local 49 at Good Samaritan Regional Medical Center in Corvallis and nearby Albany General Hospital settled a new contract that includes major wage increases. Emergency room technicians, housekeepers, and dietary staff are among the 600 employees included in the contract. Daphne DeSotel is a certified nursing assistant at Good Samaritan. She says she and her co-workers are pleased with the outcome and it comes at the right time.
Grocery is going up, cost of living is going up, so they're happy to get some raise. We're getting at least 8% on the first of the year.
The average wage increase for Good Samaritan workers is 18% over the life of the contract through 2024. At Albany General Hospital, the average increase is 23%, so that employees at both hospitals receive equitable pay. DeSotel says the increases, which are also for starting wages, are key for retaining and recruiting workers. She says Good Samaritan has been understaffed as the pandemic has trudged on. The virus is taking a heavy toll on healthcare workers as shortages nationwide pile up. DeSattel says she's proud to work at Good Samaritan and still takes the time to go above and beyond for her patients.
When I take care of this patient, I always look at them that it could be my father, my husband, my uncle, my son. So even though we're so busy, I have to take the time to give them the quality of care that they deserve.
DeSattel says they are continuing to work to make healthcare for workers more affordable. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Washington State is among 11 others in the U.S. that will count incarcerated people as part of their hometowns instead of the places where they are in prison. Supporters of the policy say so-called prison gerrymandering can dilute the power of communities affected by mass incarceration. Eric Tegedoff has more with the Public News Service.
The recent release of detailed census data means states can begin drawing up new voting maps. In Washington state, a new law will change the way prison populations are counted. The measure reallocates people who are incarcerated away from the places where they're imprisoned back to their home addresses. Wanda Bertram with the Prison Policy Initiative says it's inappropriate to count incarcerated people as residents of their prison cells.
For one thing, because they don't consider themselves to be members of the community almost all the time. And most people in prison within a few years are actually going to leave the district, either to be transferred to a different prison or to go back to their own hometowns.
The Washington state measure ending what some call prison gerrymandering passed in 2019. Bertram notes that the law applies only when the state is drawing state district lines, not to local governments such as cities and school boards when they're drawing lines. The end of prison gerrymandering will affect a number of communities, such as Monroe, which is about 30 miles outside of Seattle and home to the Monroe Correctional Complex. Bertram says the prison population there is about 12% of the overall population. In Connell, a town in the southeast part of the state near Kennewick, the share is even greater at about 44% of the population. But Bertram says counting these folks as part of these communities distorts the map.
At the level of society overall, we don't want this transference of political power away from the communities most impacted by mass incarceration and towards the communities where prisons happen to be located.
She says prison gerrymandering shows one way mass incarceration has impacts beyond the people in prison. Bertram notes that some neighborhoods, especially those home to people of color, are policed at higher rates. And when people who are incarcerated are not counted as part of those communities, it dilutes their political power.
It actually holds back reform. It eats away at the momentum for criminal justice reform. So this has real impacts on the law, has impacts on how resources are allocated. And I think that states and counties really can't fix it soon enough.
Washington is among 11 states that have ended prison gerrymandering. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Biden administration has approved a significant and permanent increase in the levels of food stamp assistance available to needy families, the largest single increase in the program's history. KBOO's Josh Salem has the story.
The Biden administration approved the biggest increase ever to the food stamp assistance program starting in October. The average benefit for food stamp recipients will increase 27% versus pre-pandemic levels. In actual numbers, the average monthly benefit per person will rise from $121 to $157. Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, the official name for food stamps, is used by 1 in 8 Americans. The increase is part of the Biden administration's efforts to strengthen the country's social safety net, which the pandemic demonstrated as inadequate. Many Americans' resources are limited, with some forced to choose cheap, less nutritious foods, or even go hungry as households run out of money by the end of the month. A temporary increase of 15% expires next month. Increasing the benefit increases the annual cost of the program by $19 billion. Food stamp enrollment grew by 15% over the past year or so compared to before the pandemic. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says providing a bigger food benefit will lead to better health outcomes for children. The assistance will be available to all 42 million program beneficiaries. The increase is said to be permanent. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
You You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund's investment into a spyware company. Then at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And at 7, we'll hear Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be partly cloudy with a low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow will again be partly cloudy with a high of 75. Today in history, in 1977, popular music icon Elvis Presley dies in Memphis, Tennessee at the age of 42. The death of the King of Rock and Roll brought legions of mourning fans to Graceland, his mansion in Memphis. Doctors say he died of a heart attack, likely brought on by his addiction to prescription barbiturates. The quote of the day is from American musician Elvis Presley, who said, quote, "The image is one thing and the human being is another. It's very hard to live up to an image, put it that way." American women die in childbirth at a rate higher than any other developed nation, and non-Hispanic Black women are 3 times more likely to die from complications in childbirth than white women. With more on the story, it's Choma Uwagu with the Racial Reckoning Project.
American women die in childbirth at a higher rate than in any other developed nation, according to the American Diabetes Association. Within the United States, non-Hispanic Black women are 3 times more likely to have a maternal death than white women. In light of these painful disparities, many women of color are getting involved in birth work.
A lot of us as birthing parents are looking for solutions to just save our lives. How do we survive the experience of giving birth and live to tell about it? And how do we have not just an experience that we can survive from, but that we feel empowered and supported in?
Maternal health advocate Brittany Wright advocates for public policies that impact mothers, particularly Black mothers. She was compelled to enter birth work after her own experience in 2018.
I kept advocating for myself since the moment I got to the hospital. Something is wrong, abandoned my birth plan. And they kept telling me, oh, well, it's just painful contractions. You're a first-time mom. You're just not used to it. And in the 20th hour of labor, they finally started to believe me.
The doctor credited for much of modern gynecology, James Marlon Sims, experimented on enslaved women without anesthesia. Wright says, given the racist roots of gynecology, it's not an accident that present-day systems underserve communities of color.
So when we look at all of the ways in which Black bodies have been exploited, what does it look like to do the exact opposite of that and to uplift Black bodies, to center them, and to provide them with the care that we have historically been denied?
Wright is in the process of opening a holistic birthing center that integrates ancient cultural practices into the birthing experience. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Choma Uwagu.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center.
Afghanistan's president flees the country as the Taliban advances, unvaccinated COVID-19 patients threaten to overrun hospitals, and census data shows the U.S. becoming more diverse. With more on those stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
U.S. forces Afghanistan forward continue to provide security at the Kabul airport and at the embassy. These are the existing security elements that were already in Kabul.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby on the removal of U.S. civilians from the country. Overnight, U.S. troops evacuated Americans and Afghan allies as the Taliban seemed poised to finish its takeover. The Afghan government appears to have fallen, and President Ashraf Ghani has fled. In a statement released by the White House, President Biden said that continuing a military presence would not have made a difference after more than 20 years of conflict in the country. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves says the state faces a new peak peak in coronavirus cases. 97% of new cases and 89% of hospitalizations there are unvaccinated.
I believe the vaccines are safe. I believe they are effective. And I believe that they are the best tool we have moving forward to beat the virus.
Hospitals in Mississippi and several other states are on the verge of being overwhelmed. A CDC advisory panel on Friday recommended a third vaccine shot for people with moderately to severely weakened immune systems. In other news, the Biden administration has made the largest permanent increase to SNAP benefits in the program's history. Under rules to be announced today, average benefits will rise more than a quarter from pre-pandemic levels. The census says the U.S. is becoming more diverse more quickly. In each of the 50 states, the number of white Americans is lower than 2010. In total, around 57% of the population, a new low. National correspondent for The Hill, Reed Wilson, says some of that is due to how people are describing themselves, but not all.
People are having kids later in life. They're having fewer kids. The opioid epidemic has taken a real toll on rural America. And there is a minor technical change in the census in that they gave more people the opportunity to call themselves multiracial or members of other races that they hadn't in the past.
In Nashville, Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel pledged that Republicans would take back the House and Senate in 2022 and take back the White House in 2024. She criticized the Biden administration's handling of election security, the U.S.-Mexico border, and violent crime.
Shootings and homicides are up. Cops are retiring in record numbers. Democrat-run cities like Chicago, D.C., New York, Oakland, and Seattle are failing. And Joe Biden still refuses to condemn the dangerous defund the police movement.
A 7.2 magnitude earthquake struck Haiti over the weekend, killing more than 700 people. Haiti's new prime minister, Ariel Henry, tweeted that he was declaring a month-long state of emergency. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The U.S. Census shows big gains for Native American and Alaska Native populations, and the Forest County Potawatomi community warns of COVID-19 cases linked to a recent powwow. With those stories and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause in for Antonia Gonzalez. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, its 2020 demographic data shows about a 25% increase from the 2010 census in the number of American Indians and Alaska Natives who self-reported and were not combined with any other race. That puts the estimated total about 3.7 million, or 1.1% of the total U.S. population. Between the 2010 and 2020 data, American Indians and Alaska Natives who reported in a combination with another race rose by about 160% and now account for 2.9% of the total population. The census data will be used to determine levels of federal funding to tribes and tribal communities, as well as legislative redistricting. Tribal and health officials with the Forest County Potawatomi community are warning of COVID-19 cases that have been linked to the tribe's recent powwow in Wisconsin. Daniel Kading reports.
As of Thursday, a tribal spokesperson confirmed that 2 people who attended the powwow had tested positive for the virus. Tribal Chairman Ned Daniels Jr. said in an announcement on social media that the tribe is taking extra precautions, including postponing future large gatherings.
I don't ever want to see our community shut down because of this virus again, but postponing a large gathering is one way we can help right now.
The Lac du Flambeau and Menominee tribes are also urging people to get tested if they attended the event. Medical Director Amy Slagle with the Menominee Tribal Clinic said they had tested about 40 people as of Thursday.
None have been positive who've identified as being at that powwow.
But Slagle says it may be this week before any new cases emerge that could be tied to the event. The powwow typically draws hundreds of people from across the region. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
A federal appeals court is considering the case of a woman who was raped by a Bureau of Indian Affairs officer, and now it's asking Montana Supreme Court to determine whether law enforcement agencies in the state can be held liable when their on-duty officers sexually assault someone. Montana Public Radio's Freddie Manadas has more.
The question from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals stems from a 2018 federal case in which former BIA officer Dana Bullcoming coerced and impregnated a Northern Cheyenne woman after threatening to arrest her. The woman, identified by her initials in court documents, sued Bull Cumming, the BIA, and the federal government for damages and child support. A judge found Bull Cumming liable for the rape and awarded the woman $1.6 million. However, the judge ruled the federal government, including the BIA, was not liable for Bull Cumming's actions. That's different from Montana laws, which allow local law enforcement agencies to be held liable for actions of their on-duty officers. In the court's question to the High Court filed Monday, they write, this federal policy creates a dichotomy that likely has a disproportionate effect on Montana's indigenous population, who are more likely to interact with federal officers. Bull Cumming pleaded guilty in 2018 to deprivation of rights under the color of law and is serving a 3-year prison sentence. For National Native News, I'm Freddie Monades.
The Navajo Nation will return to its orange status restrictions in the wake of a new surge of COVID-19 cases. The restrictions will include capacity levels for businesses. On August 11th, the Navajo Department of Health reported 49 new COVID-19 cases for the nation and 2 more deaths. A blood quantum requirement prevents Native Hawaiians from passing their land leases under the 1920 Hawaiian Homes Commission Act to family members with less than 1/4 Hawaiian blood. A proposed federal bill would lower the blood quantum requirements from 25% to about 3%. A former Navajo Nation president has passed away. 5th Navajo Nation president Kelsey Begay died of natural causes Friday in Flagstaff, Arizona. He was 70. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
Phillipstown, New York residents are working together to cut carbon. The town aims to be carbon neutral by 2040. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on that story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. At nighttime in Phillipstown, New York, orange LED bulbs glow from windows and porches. The lights signal that a home or business has pledged to reduce carbon as part of the Phillipstown Fights Dirty campaign. The goal is for the town to become carbon neutral by the year 2040. And to make that happen,
each resident of Phillipstown has to cut 1 ton of carbon each year for the next 20 years.
Jocelyn Apicello is with the Ecological Citizens Project, a nonprofit that's helping the town run the campaign. She says participants take a range of actions, from installing solar or buying an EV to washing clothes in cold water and installing efficient light bulbs. Some have also volunteered to knock on doors and make calls to help get their neighbors involved. These volunteers are armed with information, for example, about the Phillipstown Climate Fund. This fund helps low and moderate income households afford the direct costs of cutting carbon.
We believe firmly that climate action shouldn't be a privilege, and so we want to find ways to bring everybody on board.
So by offering solidarity and support, organizers hope to make climate action contagious and see more orange light bulbs throughout the town. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 16th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Ethan Sandweiss, and David Rosenberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Trip Krause, Choma Uwagu, Nadia Ramagan, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy. They cover politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, it's Alternative Radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Host Joseph Gallivan interviews Cassandra Swan, Ruben Lawrence, Asa Wright, Kira Watkins, all about the new Pride Northwest mural at 8th and Cooch in Old Town. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give, or you can text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth. We're looking at the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund investment into a spyware company.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Oregon's Public Employee Retirement System, or PERS, is now the largest shareholder in the NSO Group, an Israeli spyware company. NSO's software Pegasus has been used by oppressive regimes to hack the phones of 50,000 journalists and foreign officials, including associates of murdered Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi and French President Emmanuel Macron. PERS invested $250 million in the group via the Oregon State Treasury. Now the pension fund is quietly and discreetly working to liquidate its investment so it can be passed on to other investors. Richard Silverstein is an independent journalist based in Seattle. He's written for Al Jazeera, Jacobin Magazine, and The Nation, and since 2003, he's written Tikkun Olam, a progressive Jewish blog. Thanks for joining me today, Richard.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Ethan.
Why is this investment in NSO problematic for PERS?
The Israeli spyware company NSO Group is one of the largest and most lucrative spyware makers in the world. And it was recently exposed in a major media expose by 16 media companies that collaborated, showing that its technology was used by intelligence agencies, police agencies, and repressive regimes in 50 countries, and that they had a list of 50,000 telephone cell phone numbers that they were trying to target. And NSO's technology has been used in the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi. It was also played a role in the murder of a journalist in Mexico. And it's been known for several years about the damaging role that NSO plays. And aside from the technology, NSO is a tremendously lucrative business. The value of the company when it was last sold was $1 billion, which made it a unicorn in terms of venture capital. It was sold to a private investment company in the UK called Novalpina. Novalpina had basically two companies that it owned, one of whom, the most largest, was NSO Group. So the Treasury invested $225 million or $250 million from PERS, from the retirees, from the Public Employee Pension Fund, in Novalpina. After that investment happened, Novalpina had three partners that made this decision. One of them introduced a lawsuit against the Guardian newspaper. And as a result of the lawsuit, there was a huge breakup between the three partners. And they basically were at war with each other legally and couldn't really control the commercial entity, make any decisions. And that's why the Treasury basically, as an outside investor, had a last recourse to take over the company. And that's what the State Treasury did in this case. And they have basically tried to hire the Berkeley Resource Group, which is based in California, which is basically a liquidator. So Berkeley Research Group is basically going to liquidate NSO Group to the highest bidder, and the Treasury hopes to get some of its money back. I have been trying to get the Treasury to answer a few questions that I have. One is, how was the decision made to invest in Novalpina? Why was the decision made? The other question was, does the state treasury, when it invests, have any legal, any ethical guidelines, any diversity guidelines, any human rights guidelines that govern their investments? The only principles that I find are maximizing the value of the investment, and their financial principles that they have. So I'm shocked basically at the reputation that Oregon has as a state being fairly liberal, democratic, that they don't have in place principles that many other retirement systems have when they do their investments. And it's shocking to me that no one in the Treasury, when this investment was made, asked themselves, should we be investing in malware? And the, you know, it's not, NSO has not been hiding under a rock. I mean, the scores of articles revealing the extreme damage that this company has done to human rights activists, to journalists, to the parents of 43 disappeared and murdered students in Mexico, and told also the types of people that are using this, using this technology. Leaders of repressive regimes in Azerbaijan and Mexico and India, and using them against their political enemies. And NSO Group, I should say, claims that the purpose of their technology is to capture drug gangs and to detect terrorists, but hardly any of the customers use it in that way. So basically what they're doing is selling to dictators who see enemies everywhere inside their own country, and they're using it to infect the phones of these dissidents and allow them to be either arrested or tortured or murdered in certain cases. So I'm really more than shocked that the Treasury has made such a cavalier investment. And I'm also shocked that the only article on this situation in Oregon that came out was the AP correspondent in Salem wrote a short piece about this, and that's it. Nobody else until KABU has shown interest, thankfully to you, in this. And this is a major investment in the state's treasury, and I think that the decision makers should be held accountable for what they did. They should explain what they did and why they did it.
So just to make sure that I'm understanding you perfectly clearly, it sounds like the Oregon Public Employees Retirement System is now the largest stakeholder in a company that's been violating human rights for repressive regimes all around the world.
That's right. They were what's called an outside investor, so they weren't managing NSO. They basically put their money in, and they let Novalpina and NSO executives themselves sort of run the show and run the investment. But when the courts decided that Novalpina was no longer a functioning entity, that's when an element of the contract that was signed gave PERS the ability to come in, swoop in, and take control of the investment. And that's what's happened now.
So leaving aside even the fact that this was obviously a very unethical investment from the get-go, and it's surprising that nobody in the straight treasury caught that and decided to bring it up, how is this even a legal investment? I mean, it sounds like NSO has been breaking a lot of what's just commonly understood as international law.
It's a wild west out there. There's no United Nations treaty that governs how spyware should be used or shouldn't be used. And very few countries, if any, have any regulation on how spyware, how surveillance technology should be used against their citizens. There absolutely needs to be regulation of spyware. And Edward Snowden is someone who's proposed a radical solution. He has suggested there should be no market for spyware at all. It should be illegal, period. There are other people who go a little, not quite as far, and say that the technology should be regulated and only legitimate uses should be permitted and illegitimate should not. The problem is that different countries have different definitions of what would be legitimate. In a democracy, it would not be permitted to go after citizens engaged in legitimate protest. But in a country like Azerbaijan or India or any other Hungary, these are autocratic leaders who use their secret police and intelligence agencies to harass and persecute people who oppose these regimes. And so they would define these people you and I would call legitimate as criminals. So I think it's difficult to parse this, but it's really important that there not be just NGOs like Citizen Lab and Amnesty being the ones to oppose and to point out the excesses of NSO. This needs to be done on a very defined way. And I might add that your Senator Wyden, Ron Wyden, in a Senate hearing proposed exactly that the United States regulate spyware, that they impose penalties on companies that abuse the spyware, and that they impose penalties on investors who benefit from buying companies like NSO, if NSO were to violate U.S. law. And six individual members of Congress have sent out a message called Enough is Enough. Two members from California and one from New Jersey, Democratic, Liberal Democrats, who have proposed the same thing. So we now have just the beginnings of a legislative push to make this issue, to bring it into a higher visibility on the legislative agenda. So that needs to be reinforced.
I want to talk a little more about Pegasus as a product. So there was recently a 16 media outlet expose on Pegasus itself, this principal product of the NSO group. What exactly does Pegasus allow these governments to do? And what has it allowed governments to do?
Pegasus is the most powerful spyware ever devised on the commercial market. Pegasus is the most lucrative product in this market niche as well. What it does is it infects cell phones, and it can take control of your cell phone, and it can monitor everything that anyone does on a cell phone. That would include your text messages. It can intercept email messages, voice messages, audio, video, your browsing history, every web page that you visit. Your life on your cell phone becomes an open book to the client states and the intelligence agencies that use this software. And one person described this as having someone inside your brain. That's how invasive, and that's how scary this is, really, and how much they can know about us. They can know our private thoughts, and they can often, even if they don't have the exact information they want, they can infer a lot of things from what we do. They can infer from physically where we go every day, what we do every day, who we visit every day, who we send emails to, and they can know not only what we're doing and thinking, but they know what the person that you communicate with is doing the thinking. So if you send an email to your best friend or a human rights collaborator or your lawyer, they know what the lawyer is doing as well as they knowing what you do. So it's a product that really sends its tentacles out far from the victim and the cell phone that the victim has. It just spreads these tentacles very, very far across society.
Returning to PURSE, the Oregon State Pension Fund has $250 million invested in the NSO group, which they're now working to liquidate. Once that happens, I mean, what's the next step? Is there going to be accountability? Is there going to be some kind of sanctioning of the NSO group? Like, What do you think is going to happen moving forward?
Theoretically, once they liquidate their investment with this company, Berkeley Research Group, that they're hiring to sell the company, NSO to another investor, they could go ahead and they could invest in an NSO competitor, another spyware company, or any other company that they thought they would get a major return on their investment, no matter what the ethical considerations. And I'm troubled by a public employee retirement fund with hundreds of billions of dollars in investments that has no consideration for ethics in their deliberations. I understand why you want to make a profit, and that's totally legitimate. Retirees, of course, need to have their future guaranteed by the money that's been invested on their behalf. But I think those retirees would also want to know that the profits that are going to be given to them when they retire are not dirty money, are not dark money, are not money based on human suffering and the murder of journalists. I mean, that's a pretty nasty way to guarantee your future retirement on the backs of, on the dead bodies of journalists. Also, there's no restriction on who might buy this company. So it could be another state retiree pension fund or another an investor like Noble Pina could come along and say, there's a lot of money to be made here from NSO. So we have to hold accountable the people that enable these companies to exist financially. NSO could not exist unless it was making a huge amount of money, and without companies like Noble Pina or PERS or the Treasurer putting their money into NSO, it couldn't have 50 clients around the world. It couldn't hack the cell phones of 50,000 people. So the money, the people with the money also need to be held accountable.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Richard. And thanks so much for talking about NSO Group and everything that's been going on there.
Thanks a lot, Ethan. Appreciate being with you.
That was independent journalist Richard Silverstein on Oregon's public employee retirement system's $250 million investment and partial ownership of the NSO Group, an Israeli spyware company implicated in the murder and intimidation of journalists. Neither the pension fund nor the Oregon State Treasury were available for comment. From KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
Farming world dominated by large agribusiness companies, the sustainable agriculture movement has had quite an uphill climb. But the movement, which was once dismissed as being impractical or utopian, is now gaining ground. Robert Jensen is a retired professor at the School of Journalism and Media at the University of Texas, a founding board member of the Third Coast Activist Resource Center, and part of the Ecosphere Studies team at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. Much of Jensen's work at the Institute has been in collaboration with Wes Jackson, one of the founders of the sustainable agriculture movement. KPFA weekend news anchor and KBOO contributor David Rosenberg spoke with Jensen about how he got involved with the Land Institute and about the movement to create a more ecologically based type of farming.
I first started reading the work of Wes Jackson, the co-founder of the Land Institute, more than 30 years ago. And he helped me understand the nature of the ecological crises in a different way that was consistent with the other critiques I was learning at the time, critiques of patriarchy, of white supremacy, of capitalism, of imperialism, all came at a time in which my critical sensibilities were expanding. And one key component of that was understanding the nature of these ecological crises. I continued to spend most of my career working on the social problems, on the problem of media concentration and media distortion, looking at US interventions in the world, a critique of male dominance and exploitation of women, those kind of things. But as I've gotten older, I've spent more and more of my time looking at those ecological crises, which has led me to working directly with Wes on some books and working with others at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas, where they're doing, I think, some of the most exciting and important work on sustainable agriculture.
Were you also influenced by the work of Wendell Berry?
Yeah, Wes and Wendell are old friends. I often would describe Wes as the scientific half and Wendell as the literary half of one person. Both of them rooted in rural histories, both of them sharp critics of capitalist industrial agriculture, and then looking at different ways to try and imagine a sustainable future.
How is the Land Institute pointing the way toward that kind of future? And is it distinctive from other ecological approaches?
So the Land Institute was founded in 1976 as an alternative school, but it shifted over the years to be more of a research institution and now is really the world hub for research on perennial grains, especially the possibility of perennial grains grown in mixtures or polycultures. Now, that sounds kind of technical, but it's really quite simple. About two-thirds of the calories of the human species, most of the food we eat, come from annual grains, white, wheat, rice, corn, soybeans, things we treat as annual grains. And the problem is, of course, annual grains require annual plowing or heavy chemical inputs, and they are ecologically destructive. Annual grain farming is now, 10,000 years old and has steadily been drawing down the ecological capital of the planet. That's all intensified in the industrial area, the industrial era, the so-called Green Revolution, where petrochemicals have become central. So the question Wes asked more than four decades ago was, can we move from annual grains, which are directly related to soil erosion and soil degradation, to perennial grains that will come up year after year and don't need to be planted every year? That's the insight of what Wes calls natural systems agriculture. Can we grow those perennial grains in mixtures to reduce the need for fossil fuel, the need for chemical inputs, and can we then reduce soil erosion and degradation? We talk about climate change. That's, of course, crucial. Water problems, crucial. But soil is the other, of the big three. It's climate, water, and soil. And we have been eroding soil ever since we started growing grains. Now, of course, agriculture is practiced differently around the world, depending on geography and climate. But annual grains do supply the vast majority of human calories. And therefore, if we can't change the way we grow grain, agriculture is never going to be sustainable as long as we have billions of people on the planet. So I think that's the distinctive contribution of the Land Institute. And as I said, it's research not being done only at the Land Institute. There are now researchers on every continent working on a variety of crops, now being organized under what the Land Institute calls its New Roots International program. And it's very exciting. I was at a meeting in Sweden a couple of years ago, and maybe I'm just getting old, but the most exciting thing that happened to me that year was being around a bunch of plant breeders in a university in Sweden.
Does the success of this approach depend on more emphasis on family farms and small organic farms, or can it be integrated into what you might call big agriculture?
Yeah.
Well, or agribusiness.
Yeah. Well, I think there are, of course, independent reasons to critique large-scale agriculture, to critique fossil fuel agriculture, and to critique capitalist agriculture. And at the Land Institute, many people have that critique. Personally, I don't think there is a sustainable human future in that model. I just don't think it works. So we're going to have to return to the local, to the decentralized when it comes to agriculture. And of course, around the world, this is something that people have known for some time. Big ag is not the future any more than big pharma is the future or big media is the future. Those are systems that concentrate power. They focus on wealth creation, and therefore they're not likely to be sustainable. So I think at the Land Institute, folks would say that these are kind of parallel projects. We need to figure out the science of growing crops differently, which involves both what you might call modern science, what happens in the laboratory, genetics using expensive equipment, as well as what you might call folk science, not forgetting that people have known how to grow crops in a more sustainable way for millennia now. So I feel excited about the Land Institute in part because it doesn't reject modern science, nor does it reject tradition. It looks at the intersection of those two. And at the same time, has either an explicit or an implicit critique of, you know, these big ag trends.
Any people in positions of power who are looking at this as seriously as the Land Institute, either at the state level or the federal level?
The answer is yes. When Wes started talking about perennial grains and polycultures 40 years ago, he would visit land-grant ag schools, you know, at the big schools like the University of Illinois, the University of Minnesota. And he says they would nod politely but kind of snicker at the whole idea. But over time, the idea is taking root. And in fact, there are partnerships with some of those same institutions now that once would have scoffed at Wes's idea. The USDA is involved and is putting some research funds into it. And there has been initial interest from some folks about writing this into the five-year farm bills that the U.S. government passes. You'll also find interest, you know, here and there across the states. But I don't want to, you know, oversell the idea. It's still fighting for legitimacy. Now, one indication of its viability, however, is that some of the big producers, the agribusiness companies like General Mills and such, have expressed an interest in developing Kernza products. Kernza is the current wheat-like perennial grain that the Land Institute has made the most progress with. And you can actually, you know, buy breakfast cereals made with it. It's right now in limited production. They're still working out the kinks. As you know, when Wes first started this, he predicted it would be 50 years before they had any progress. Well, they're a little ahead of schedule, but Wes is always reminding people that plant breeding comes with as many failures as successes, that you learn a lot along the way. So the Land Institute is very clear about not overselling the potential. Right now, perennial grains couldn't feed the world, but it's a big idea for the future. And there are people with money and power who are, in fact, looking at it with some interest. Because, you know, the thing about the ecological crises is people in power can kind of pretend they don't know it. But at some level, I think everyone understands that if you erode the soil, the topsoil of a country, you erode its capacity to produce food, and that doesn't end well. So I think the data about, again, not only climate change, but interruptions in the water cycle, as well as soil degradation and soil erosion, I think they have people in power worried. Not enough people are worried enough yet, but we are seeing the beginnings of them.
Any countries way ahead in this area?
No, at this point, it's kind of a consortium of people. There is perennial rice being grown in China, and a lot of work on the breeding of that rice being done in China. I can tell you I have eaten perennial rice at that meeting in Sweden that I talked about. The Chinese researchers brought perennial rice with them, and I can tell you it tastes just like rice. Couldn't tell the difference. That was great. There's perennial sorghum being developed primarily in Africa. Perennial legumes, work is very early on that. Perennial wheat is also being developed at the Land Institute. There's some new work that's pretty exciting. Perennial oil seeds, things like sunflowers. All of this is going on, as I said, on every continent, North and South America, Europe, Asia, Africa. There's work being done. It's a kind of quiet revolution in thinking about agriculture. Now, it's not the sole solution. You know, we don't want to pretend that if you got perennial grains and grew them in mixtures, magically, you know, 8 billion people could run around the world eating adequately. We have real crises when it comes to not just the, you know, the long-term future of this planet, not centuries away, but we're talking about decades away. And so, you know, nobody's got the magic bullet. It's not permaculture. It's not organic. It's not this. It's not that. It's a combination, again, using, I think, the best of modern science with the best of what we know from traditions across the world, back to and including indigenous agricultural traditions. But I also think we shouldn't be naive. Simply going organic isn't going to save the world. You know, simply everybody, you know, learning permaculture to grow some tomatoes in their backyard isn't going to save the world. It's a combination of all the things that give us at least a fighting chance to at least push this human experiment forward a little longer.
Anything else you want to add to what you said?
Well, I think the Land Institute also, in addition to the science and the agriculture, has always been a place for creative thinking about the social aspects of this. Talking again about the need for decentralized production and to restore the health of rural communities. Well, how is that actually going to happen? Because, of course, not everything about rural communities is positive. How do you blend the rural and the cosmopolitan? How do you take what we've learned from, you know, a half century of the most recent movements to challenge concentrated power and blend that with tradition? I think those are the kinds of places where you see a lot of, for me, a lot of exciting thinking. It's not dogmatic. It's not, you know, following a particular ism. It's just recognizing that there have to be new ways to think about how this human experiment is going to move forward, or it isn't going to move forward for very much longer.
That was retired University of Texas professor Robert Jensen speaking about the movement towards more ecologically sustainable farming. He spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg. This has been KBOO News in Depth. Thanks for listening.
Portland, Oregon.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Welcome to Labor Radio. I am Michael Cathcart.
And I'm Elliot Gilland.
Thank you so much for joining us. Just quickly before we start the show, we'd like to give a special thanks and shout out to the Labor Radio Podcast Network for hosting podcasted versions of our show each month. Be sure to check that out at laborradionetwork.org. And you can also hear old versions of this show as well as many other labor-related podcasts and radio shows on there. So go to laborradionetwork.org. And so today for the media